You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
You know, when we look at the long history of Black Palestinian solidarity in this country, you know, from Birmingham to Bethlehem, I think is an amazing sort of slogan to put it together, because Birmingham as the crucible of the civil rights movement and Bethlehem as the crucible in many ways of the liberation theology tradition that the civil rights movement was based on. And to see these abuses, this apartheid, this occupation happening in historic Palestine, creating a strong cultural connection and reality to that history and that rhythm and that spirit of the Black Liberation Movement, the Palestinian Liberation Movement, organizationally and at the grassroots, because it speaks to the similarities of the struggle. It speaks to the similarities of the reasons why we're both in oppressed situations. It speaks to the reality of the world today.
That's Eugene Puryear, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Eugene Puryear, From Birmingham to Bethlehem. Part one of a special two-part program. From Birmingham to Bethlehem, two iconic places saturated with meaning. As segregation and Jim Crow were described as intractable, so too is Palestine today. How can the Palestinian struggle for freedom and dignity take lessons from the Black Liberation Movement? Historical circumstances are clearly different. Yet there are similarities. Both are located in a colonial-like situation, where a powerful oppressor dominates another less powerful group. Racism is a major factor. The Black Liberation Movement and Malcolm X's eloquent voice and militant politics resonate with Palestinians struggling for their freedom. Liberation struggles are not easy. Resistance to change is entrenched. Power does not readily give up its prerogatives. Our guest today is Eugene Puryear. He's a journalist, activist, and public speaker. He's a founding member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. And he's the host and producer of Breakthrough News.
I've actually talked about Black Palestinian solidarity many times before during Black History Month over the years, but it's never felt so poignant as our current moment. And it's a long history, and it's a deep history, and it has deep connections to the undercurrents of both struggles, what they're really both about in their core essence. Two oppressed people trying to find a way to overcome their neocolonial, colonial overlords who have imposed upon them for decades, and in the case of the Black Liberation Movement, centuries, a certain form of living, and denied their humanity and denied its reality. And when you start to look at the history of Black Palestinian solidarity, it's interesting to see how it starts to come to be in a major way. I mean, you know, one of the most major figures talked about today in Black History Month is always Malcolm X, right? Well, Malcolm X was really one of the first individuals to try to build a strong bridge between the Palestinian Liberation Movement and the Black Liberation Movement in an organized sense. And it was part of his own development of his own consciousness as he starts to move in beyond the Nation of Islam. He starts to become an independent activist. He forms the Organization of African Unity, Muslim Mosque Incorporated, and he's trying to establish a different sense of what Black politics really means. And his basic understanding was that the situation of Black people in America was that of an internal colony, a nation within a nation, that the struggle of Black people was for liberation. It wasn't a struggle for democratic pluralism, that Black people were excluded from the body politic on purpose, that they were not allowed to ascend into the political structure in any significant way on purpose. It wasn't just a holdover of something that happened 300 or 400 years before, although that is where it started. His understanding was that there was a very particular reason why Black people in America were are disproportionately at the bottom of everything, which continues to be true today. It's an amazing thing when you think about it, really. I mean, poverty, unemployment, diabetes, hypertension, people being killed by the police, people going to jail. We could go on probably all night and just talk about that. If it's bad, it's disproportionately Black and indigenous. And that, of course, is because of the roots of what has brought us to this point. ultimately, you had a situation in the United States, or at that time, previously United States, the colonies, whatever you want to call them, at that moment, where those enterprises were more or less failed institutions. You know, they thought they were going to come here and they were going to do a lot. It wasn't working out. People were dying. People were leaving. They had to try to find a way to create a certain level of dynamism. And they're searching for this. They're searching for that. I mean, the whole reason they came here originally, or at least, you know, some of them, some, I guess, to escape, you know, religious X, Y, and Z. But a lot of people thought they were going to find gold. And that's why they thought it was going to be, you know, very lucrative for them. This is actually why Columbus even came in this direction, the original point. But that being said, they thought similar, like the British colonies, like the Spanish, they'd find some natural resources and that would help them. Didn't work out. Or maybe they'd find some other, you know, furs, different pieces like that. Wasn't really a major industry. But they were able to figure something out over time, and that was they figured out how to deal drugs. And I say that very directly, because ultimately the narrative of how you describe something determines ultimately how you view it. And of course, in our civics class version of American history, it was freedom, justice, democracy, all these different things, which didn't really exist in any significant way at the time. But if that's the narrative of what took place, it gives you a very different framing for the reality of how and why the country was founded. But ultimately, what gave the dynamism to what would become the United States was the fact that, at least initially, they found sugar and tobacco. Now, sugar, of course, and this maybe tells you something too. We don't even think about it as a drug now because it's in everything. Sugar's all over the place. But as I've said a few times before, you know, anyone here who's a parent, there's a reason why you don't constantly give your kids cookies, because you understand not only the impact on their health, but also the fact that it starts to, you know, it builds on itself, that it becomes an addiction, and it starts to become something that you have to have all the time. And ultimately, all these products, Coke, Pepsi, Oreos or whatever, I mean, everything around us, even the coffee industry are really based on this. So we can see it even in our own lives today and in the way that it operates. But certainly then it was a little bit more of a revelation, because back then many people in Europe did not have access to sugar. It was like a luxury good. And this was the first opportunity that, you know, other people had the opportunity to have a little bit of a sugar high, if you will, in their daily lives. Same thing with tobacco. You smoke it, you get high. You know, this is, you know, just out of feudalism Europe. It's not like people are living high quality lives by and large. So if you, you know, can drink a little something, smoke a little something and feel a little bit more calm, you can see that there's a certain value in that. And it creates a constantly expanding market. And in the context of that, you have to find a way to get people to work, to continue to grow the way you're doing these crops, these plantations and different pieces. And they had a lot of different ideas about how that could potentially take place. The indigenous people, they were first going to try to enslave them. Didn't work out the way they expected. Not only did the indigenous people resist, but, you know, listen, this was their land, their territory. The people who lived there were like them. So it was much easier for them to run away, in addition to just straight up resistance. You know, you enslave me, you put me here, you say you're working here, well, I go 50 miles away. Who's gonna know the difference? Who's gonna be able to find me? So that doesn't work, you know, right off the bat. They didn't say, well, let's get indentured servants over here. We got a lot of poor, destitute people in Europe. A lot of them were putting in prisons, debtor prisons, by the way. Georgia, the state of Georgia, this is an interesting fact maybe that you'd be curious in. The whole basis of Georgia was to bring poor whites out of debtors' prisons to keep a buffer between Florida and South Carolina, because the Spanish were allowing escaped slaves from South Carolina to form a militia and go and raid the slave plantations in South Carolina and free the slaves and create a lot of damage. But nonetheless, they said, we're going to bring people over here. You know, we're going to sell them a good story, a good song. You come for 10 years, 20 years, you know, you get a little bit of land. This is going to happen. That's going to happen. All of that also false. And, you know, a lot of times people died before the, you know, the term was up because the conditions of existence were so bad. A lot of times you would get here and you're here now. So what are you going to do? And they would just say, oh, well, you know, you had 10 years, but look, you know, we gave you food, we gave you this, we gave you that. You're gonna have to go for another 10 years. So it becomes almost a form of kind of perpetual slavery. And some of the early indentured servants, by the way, were coming from Africa before the establishment of slavery. So then they even have an even bigger problem, because what takes place is you have these indigenous people who are trying to defend their land and carve out, you know, their own existence in this new reality with all these people coming from Europe trying to kill them and destroy them in every possible way. You've got a number of very angry individuals who've been brought to the country allegedly as servants, but they're basically in a form of servant, you know, almost slavery in a sense. And they're certainly not getting anything like what they thought they were going to get when they were, you know, sold a bill of goods and brought over here. And then they start to work together. And they figure, well, there's more of us than these plantation owners and these others that are going on, so we can wage our own form of resistance. So now you've got the opposite problem of what you were hoping for. You wanted a stable labor force, but you got a bunch of angry people who would rather overthrow you and find a way to live amongst themselves without you, and they're not really concerned about your plans and the budding industries that you're bringing forth, insurance, shipping. And it's just, you know, you hear it a lot when you talk about black reparations, but it's true. You can easily find it. There would be no banking and finance. Like, why are there deep capital markets in America? Slavery, 100%. Why do you have all this massive insurance industry? Slavery, 100%. The modern timber industry, we could be here all night talking about that, but I won't. But the basic point I'm making is this is the genesis of African slavery in America, because they figured we have to find some group of people who we can get over here and make work to keep this expanding economy going, but we have to be able to control them. So you bring people from across the ocean, so you've completely ripped them away from their context, and you know you're not going to swim back, so what are you going to do once you're here? You're trapped. So you've got a captive people, a captive nation. You've brought them from dozens of different people from all across the African continent. So not just have you ripped them from their land, you've ripped them from their entire social context, which means that they now have to band together. But since they're under your purview, you have more control over the language they speak, the religions they practice, all of these different pieces. So you're able to have a large amount of control, not just over their workforce, but their spiritual and cultural life, so you can break people's resistance. I mean, that's what it's really about. And then, of course, you pass the requisite laws, the first real laws that sort of start to bring in what we might call segregation, color caste system, to really establish slavery. First, you cannot own guns. Second, you cannot own land. Third, you cannot have interracial marriages. So that way you preserve the ability to identify based on phenotype who people are, which is obviously a form of social control. You make sure they can't build up independent wealth because they have no land. And you make sure they can't defend themselves because they can't own firearms. So you have this overall system that becomes extremely profitable and actually becomes the pivot point for the rise of capitalism, not just in the United States, in the entire world. You know, Haiti at the time of the Haitian Revolution was actually the most profitable corporation on earth. More wealth was being produced in Haiti than all of the 13 colonies, or at that time, actually, the early United States, at that time. So it gives you a sense that this was really a huge economic pivot point to grow capitalism as a system. And then even when slavery was over, you have a country that says, well, listen, this was actually working really, really well for us. And it really is a great benefit to have a certain, you know, maybe minority, but numerically large group of individuals who we can pay basically nothing and treat very bad, and by that get sort of extra profits, extra money. It really can sort of juice our economy and allow us to go to even higher heights for this elite of capitalist individuals, which is why it's a long story. Reconstruction is defeated. But nonetheless, you know, you have this pillar of capitalism. It's not an extra, it's not an alternative. It's why, even though you've had a black president, you still have everything bad is disproportionately black. It's a feature, not a bug, of the US capitalist system. So this is what Malcolm X was starting to try to bring to the struggle. He said that our struggle is in some ways a struggle for democracy, but it's not really a struggle like, say, you know, the Irish becoming more integrated into America, or the Italians becoming more integrated into America, because their relationship to the country, especially whiteness, is very different. Our struggle is, in his feeling, more akin to the colonized people of the world and those who are fighting against neocolonialism, because their existence is the same type of existence that we have. Their very own oppression and colonization exist only for the benefit of a small number of, believe it or not, the same people in America and Europe who really want to get rich by controlling really the whole world, and by subjecting, you know, most of the colonized world to disproportionate forms of exploitation, as every other, you know, quote unquote worker, farmer, peasant, or whatever. So somewhat similar to the United States. So in this understanding, one of the most important things for Malcolm X in terms of how the black liberation movement is going to move forward is it has to look for its natural allies. It has to find the other anti-colonial, anti-imperialist forces around the world whose story is similar on a narrative level, of course, and you could talk all day about how similar your struggle is to the others, but that has the same enemy because it serves the same purpose. So he very quickly starts to move in many different directions, but one of the main directions he starts to move is towards, you know, Middle East, West Asia, of what you might call then, because of course, you know, Egypt under Nasser and what was happening with the Algerian liberation movement, all these different pieces. This area of the world was really a cradle for anti-colonial struggle and resistance. And of course, Malcolm X is also a Muslim. And so he's looking to go to the traditional areas, also the heartlands of Islam, and make close connections between the Islamic world and the black liberation movement. And so in the context of this, it starts to bring him into contact with the Palestinian people. He goes to Gaza in 1964. He meets with the top jurist of Gaza. People, maybe you've seen the photo of Malcolm X shaking hands with an imam in Gaza. That was the top jurist, the top judge of Gaza at that time. He meets with the early leaders of the PLO, which becomes Foreign Palestinian Liberation Organization in 1964, and starts to forge ties with them as well. And obviously, the natural rhythm is clear because the nature of the Palestinian struggle is so similar. I mean, why is it? Why is it that Zionism is in this space? Because, you know, when Zionism first started saying we need to create our own country somewhere, at first they were going to go to Uganda, believe it or not. They were also thinking about Argentina as well. For various reasons, they thought both of those, it's not really going to work the way we want it to work. You know, and one being, and we can see this even now today, right, the narrative power of being able to connect to the stories of the Old Testament, the sort of historic reality of the Holy Land. It gives you sort of a narrative benefit there in terms of why you should be there and steal the land. And let's just be clear, the land is stolen. You know, in 1948, when they start, they own 6% of the land. They wage a war, kill 15,000 people, expel 750,000 others. Then they own 78% of the land. Well, that you stole the land. You didn't buy it. You took the majority of the land you didn't own. But why were they able to succeed is the real question. Because the desire of Zionism to have a homeland by picking this particular area of the world actually coincided with another very important motion. And that's in the post-World War I era, the desire of the British Empire to take over everything that had been controlled by the Ottoman Empire. Because the British Empire, you know, is the biggest empire. Rule Britannia. England rules the seas. The sun never sets on the British Empire. So they see a big opportunity after World War I, along with France, but mainly the British, to take over the former colonial territories of the Ottoman Empire in this case, but also Germany in other cases, in order to increase their own power. And it's an important, you know, element, because not only is this just generally for thousands of years, right, this is the crossroads of the world. But beyond that, you're starting to also see the emergence of oil as a commodity. So there's a lot of, you know, key things. You got the Suez Canal, which of course the British have been working since the mid-1800s to control. You've got oil starting to emerge as a big issue here. But you have to be able to critically control the area. And again, this is the benefit of history and really going to the primary sources, because most of the Zionist leaders were very open talking and writing about this at the time. They felt no compunction. But what they realized right away, and what they would say to themselves is, listen, we could never really survive in this area. Like, we're not going to be able to steal the land and be a decided minority from, you know, hundreds of millions of people whose very aspiration at this time is to be free. I mean, why was it that you had the quote-unquote Arab revolt at that time? Because you had people who were looking to leverage the British against the Ottomans to free the Arab nations so they could, you know, work on their own lives and improve their own situation. And so there's no way for Zionism to stay there and to say, like, yes, we're going to control this territory, unless, as they said, we have a real powerful friend. And you can't have a more powerful friend than the British Empire at that time. So, and America, of course, has just stepped right into that space. So ultimately, these two things coincide. And the British and the Balfour Declaration, and this is why we talk a lot about 1948. Let's talk about 1917, 1918, 1919, 1920, and what the British did then. That's critically important to understand this. They say, okay, cool. Sounds like a great idea to us. Because what they're saying to them is, look, if you back us, we will be the 100% backers of Britain and the West. I mean, this is the whole language they're using. They're saying we'd be a bulwark for Western civilization against Asian barbarism. That's how they talked. You know, now they say it's not racist in its roots. Well, go read what they were saying at the time and then tell me it's not racist. I mean, you can see what's happening now, but just look at how it started. In that context, you know, you have the emergence of this moment where the British decide to create this space where you're going to have this homeland. So this is the identification that Malcolm X and these early Palestinian leaders are making amongst each other, because they're able to see the similarities, very different stories in many ways, although similar sort of players when we're talking about these various imperial powers. But they could see a various similarity about how both sides had ended up in a pretty bad position, that they had basically ended up there because their oppression was extremely profitable for someone else, and that ultimately that someone else tended to be the same people. So that maybe if they found a way to get together against a common enemy, they could actually liberate themselves in a very profound way, because as isolated struggles, it would be difficult to break out. You know, it'd be easy to isolate. I mean, this is the essence of British imperialism, right? And all imperialism. The Romans used to say it, divide and conquer. That was their strategy. The British, when you read the colonial, if you go, it's actually interesting if you want to ever do this research and you go to London, you can go to all the colonial office. It's very well, the records, very well kept. And they're talking about it. They're saying we have to be, if we want to take over India and these other places, just like the Romans, divide and conquer. So, you know, the Palestinian Liberation Movement, the Arab Nationalist Movement, the Black Liberation Movement are all thinking at this time, we have to move closer together because they want us to be divided, whether it be language, whether it be religion, whether it be nationality and patriotism. And this is the essence of what Malcolm X is trying to say. If you count your struggle in the essence of American patriotism, you can't win, because it means that you're going to isolate yourself from your most natural allies around the world. So they start to come together in a much more profound way by recognizing these understandings. Malcolm X is, of course, brutally assassinated February 21st, 1965, Audubon Ballroom. We now know, and we knew then, but we now know the FBI, the NYPD coming together and doing their own divide and conquer of elements in the Black movement to make this possible. So that very hopeful moment is in some ways scattered, but in other ways starts to come together powerfully. 1966, especially 1967, because of the rise of what has been, you know, known in the literature as the Black Power movement. And in this context, you have this understanding of Malcolm X's starting to become more generally diffuse amongst Black people in general, because ultimately the Southern Freedom Movement is able to win some huge victories. You know, the Voting Rights Act, you know, the integration of schools and education and public places and all these things. But nonetheless, it was easy enough for Black people to see that that was good. In many ways, great, but it was deeply insufficient to actually become free, especially in the North, where there was never de facto, de jure segregation, just de facto, which meant it was a lot harder to sort of dig up and made people think a little bit more about the systemic realities of racism and how, you know, it wasn't just a bug, it was a feature, and that you had to really start to address the system more deeply, what Malcolm X had been saying. So this starts to become a deeper part of the consciousness, and in 1967, and this becomes a big breakpoint, because of course by 67, the, you know, civil rights movement, the Black Liberation Movement, most of the entities and organizations are speaking out against the Vietnam War and also raising other issues that were happening, some that we've sort of lost, you know, the 1965 struggle in the Dominican Republic, the emergence of the Puerto Rican, or the reemergence, I should say, of the Puerto Rican Liberation Movement, you know, things that were happening all across the African continent. So you have this greater consciousness starting to arise among really the sort of broad base of Black people in this country about the sort of nation within a nation, the internal colony reality, the importance of making and do and building solidarity between other struggles against colonialism and imperialism, and again, basically the same people. You know, if you're living in Chile, Angola, Harlem, you know, Chase Manhattan Bank is definitely your enemy, right? So people can make these connections. So the 67 war then becomes something that you have no choice but to have a position on. But it's this huge moment. I mean, you know, you had the Suez Canal issue in 1956, but, you know, you have this massive emergence of Arab nationalism coming to the forefront. So this is a world historic moment in this region, which has become only more geopolitically significant because of oil, because of the rise of modern industry. So what position are you going to take? And many, not many, some individuals who are involved in the civil rights movement, had some Zionist proclivities. So there was a fear of what you might lose if you take a strong position. Some didn't take as strong a position as I certainly might have liked. But even that has been, you know, manipulated. Dr. Martin Luther King, of course, is being constantly invoked by Zionists now. They had the Super Bowl ad with his aide, you know, in there, Clarence Jones. I didn't even know he was still alive, but, you know, there it is. The only thing I heard him say in 25 years is to come out and be for Zionism. But the point being, you know, there's this whole thing that, like, Martin Luther King was for Israel. Now, I don't, that's a separate talk, but what's important, I think, in this understanding, especially in our current moment, is he said at the time that if there's going to be peace, that the Israelis have to give back the occupied territories of what we now know as the West Bank and Gaza. So he would never have the position that they're saying he had. But let's put that aside for now. But you have in the a lot of the grassroots, especially emanating from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, a different orientation. And SNCC, of course, had been really leading the grassroots struggle for voting rights all across the South. And just to connect some things, they're having an internal conversation. And this is an issue a lot of people don't really know about. But the internal conversation is enriched by one individual by the name of Ethel Miner. Ethel Miner had worked with Malcolm X for many years, from about 1962 into 1965. And after he's assassinated, she goes to work with SNCC. She's working on the newsletter, other sort of popular education initiatives that they had. And so when this moment comes, she's saying, we have no choice but to stand with the Palestinians. Like, this is not just about whether we get hit hard, whether we lose money or whatever. Just like we stand for Vietnam, just like we stand for the Algerians, just like we stand for Angola, this is a struggle of an oppressed people for liberation, and we have to stand with them as well. And she's very convincing, of course. They come out, they take a very bold position against Zionism, against the Israelis in the 1967 war, and they do lose a lot of money. They do become significantly more isolated, but the position itself is very popular. And it starts to become the mainstream position. It's taken up by the Black Panthers. It was taken up by the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which was based in Detroit, which obviously is a large Arab American population, which also played an interesting role in that history. But there's a good book called Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, that speaks a lot about that, that's worth reading. And so you start to see suffused throughout the whole Black liberation movement, you know, A, the idea that Black people are an internal colony, a nation within a nation, that its struggle is anti-colonial and anti-imperialist, and that to be liberated, you do have to have solidarity across borders. And you have the particularity, of course, of the Palestinian struggle. So ultimately, you know, there's a lot of things happen. Ultimately, you know, there's the radical subset of the Black liberation movement is, you know, defeated, killed, imprisoned, co-opted, or whatever. But in the context of forming sort of a new Black politics, it's one of the phrases at the Times, moving from protest to politics, as Bayard Rustin would say, you know, the Congressional Black Caucus comes into being, and you have more Black people coming into political office. And in some ways, it's a contradictory phenomenon. But, you know, ultimately, you have a situation where these people are sort of setting themselves up as a separate from radicalism. Like, you can have a Black politics that isn't sort of a radical revolutionary politics, which is ultimately what almost all of Black politics was seen at that time and really was in its majority. But you can have some people who are working within the system, so on and so forth. But the proximity to the times of these great uprisings that have been taking place all across the country. I mean, you think about 1968, 125 uprisings in the country after the murder of Martin Luther King. Someone told me this story once. You drive up and down 95, you could see off of every exit, you know, the smoke that's rising from all of these places. You know, you think about how big of an impact Minneapolis had after George Floyd. Imagine that in 125 different cities across America. And so ultimately, you have to have a politics, even if it's mainstream politics, that is basically going to speak to the mass of the people. People are not going to vote for you if they think you're some sort of sellout, and if they think that you're somehow involved in the sort of broader motion of stripping radicalism from the broader context of the Black liberation movement. So I list the Congressional Black Caucus on purpose because some of these institutions start to become, inside of the American body politic, voices that are pushing what I would consider much more progressive positions, not just on Palestine, on Cuba, you know, on relations with the Soviet Union and detente, on, you know, different issues with Latin America, certainly vis-a-vis Africa and the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, and also for the recognition of the socialist governments in places like Angola and Mozambique as they start to come into being. But Palestine continues to be one of the key cornerstones of that understanding. So you have the Congressional Black Caucus, the major civil rights leaders. In 1979, there was an interesting moment where you had different leaderships or people vying for leadership of what you might call the civil rights legacy at that point. SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was Martin Luther King's organization. Jesse Jackson had started Operation Push at that time. And they were trying to, kind of vie with each other about who was going to be like the top leader. So one of the aspects that took place is, they wanted to show, they were down with the politics. So there was a race between SCLC and Jesse Jackson to go to Lebanon to meet with Yasser Arafat and the PLO leadership. Like, they wanted to be the first people to get there, each side, to say, like, no, I'm the one who's really down with the Palestinians. I was here first. I was talking to them. I'm with Palestine. But these are, mainstream, big-time black leaders at the time. So it gives you a sense of the